on. In fact, they very much dislike getting stepped on, so much so that when they are stepped on, they happen to overreact. And despite their trespassers' loud and fervent attempts at de-escalation, attack accordingly. The bees rose up in unison and set about swarming not just me, but all of us children, in retaliation. Sure, I was the one who had destroyed their nest, but they attacked us all without asking questions. Our parents watched from afar as we all came screaming back to the house, bringing the swarm with us, wailing like mad as the cloud of bees chased after us. The bees stung and bit any exposed limb with impunity as we ran, our arms flailing, swinging whatever objects we could to knock out as many bees as possible at once. When we reached the house, everybody scrambled indoors, yelping at the final stings, swinging away the most committed soldiers. Inside, the house became a full-blown triage unit, like the kind you see in movies about the Civil War, with soldiers lying in filthy beds, biting into chunks of wood while nurses saw off their exploded legs. All of us children collapsed onto the ground in various states of panic and pain, cries and screams piercing the air. It was utter madness. I'm not proud to admit that I managed, somehow, to escape with only the single initial sting, while everybody else wailed in pain around me. Naturally, of course, I was the only one to have stepped on a bee, which is a lot like accidentally shooting off your foot with a rifle. But I couldn't let on that I'd caused this whole mess and made off with only a single wound, so I writhed alongside everybody else. Still, I remain convinced that there were at least 12 other things to blame before me, including the snake, the cousin who spotted the snake, Winnie the Pooh, and most of all, the cottage itself, which I continue to believe is cursed. The trips to Michigan continued year after year, my family's enthusiasm undisturbed by mass bee attacks, poop rivers, and ongoing feuds, and the curse showed no signs of relenting either. Two summers after the bee attack, when our wounds finally showed signs of healing, I went to the cottage with my aunt, uncle, and cousins a night early. My parents and brother were driving up the next morning, but I begged and pleaded to hitch a ride the night before, reminding my mother that, without me in the car, she could fill my seat with another 20, maybe even 30 dinners, plus any number of extra breads, fruit platters, wrapped pies, and brownie trays, and I just couldn't imagine us surviving the week with anything less. Of course, she relented, if only to get me to stop listing foods and let me go. I felt guilty that night, once we arrived, to have the entire bedroom to myself. I could sleep in the real bed instead of an air mattress and snore as loud as I wanted without retribution, and in the morning, I could wake up and eat breakfast and be outside to swim long before my family would arrive. There were moments when I loved going to Michigan, and this was one of them. Besides everything that was wrong with it, the cottage could still be a fun place to be. It may not have been Disneyland, but it was better than nothing, and I made the most of it when I could. That night, my cousins and I plotted what we would do with all the extra time we'd have together in the morning. We could go fishing, which amounted to standing at the end of the long, rickety pier that jutted from the shore into the shallow water in front of the cottage, and waiting for a fish the size of a baby's shoe to decide life wasn't worth living. I will never understand the thrill of fishing. At its very best, it's an activity that ends with a vicious struggle to reel in something you can easily buy at a supermarket. And then what? You take a picture with it? So you can make that picture the cover of your dating profile? Nobody is impressed with your ability to catch a fish. Turtles can fish. Nobody is trying to fuck a turtle. Besides fishing, we could also go tubing, but tubing is only fun for about 5 minutes until you hit a small wave and are violently catapulted into the air and come crashing down into the water like you're diving into a plate of frozen steaks. And suddenly there's water and orifices you didn't know existed. The only real option was to go for an early boat ride, and the only boat we could operate ourselves was the paddle boat, the water version of a bicycle, really just exercise disguised as fun. But still, we could ride it out to the middle of the lake where the water was deepest and jump in without fear of getting grabbed by anything lurking at the bottom. So that morning we all got up and threw on our swim trunks. After breakfast, we took the requisite 2 hours to slather on SPF 1000 sunblock, a ritual that always proved pointless for our pale Anglo skin. I walked the 50 yards to the lake while I waited for my cousins to finish smearing their pasty bodies and waded a few feet into the water around the paddle boat. It was a beautiful morning, crisp, you might say, if you used words like that to describe the air and not a potato chip. The water felt brisk and refreshing, like swimming in a cold glass of lemonade, if that's your thing. It was the type of morning that made coming to this mess of a place worth it. And then I took a single step into the water, and the beauty of the morning came rupturing to a close. I felt a shooting pain in the bottom of my foot. Once again, stepping had proven to be my greatest weakness, if only I owned a pair of shoes. And when I lifted my foot from the water to look, there was a slice, almost 2 inches in length, along my heel. I'd stepped directly onto a shard of glass and cut my heel almost wide open. If I'd had the fortitude in the moment, there are plenty of people I'd like to have cursed. Namely, myself, for daring to think going outside was ever, ever a good idea, but also whichever redneck Yahoo motherfucker decided to throw a motherfucking broken bottle of shitty beer into a fucking lake. I can imagine plenty of terrible things a person can do, like getting a tattoo of another person's face, or drinking even a single swig of milk a second after the expiration date, but throwing a shard of jagged glass into the shallow part of a lake is among the worst of them, and not just because I happened to step on it, even though that maybe had something to do with it. Seriously, fuck you, sir or madam. I hope one day you step on something even worse, like a really hot beach, or one of those extra-long Legos. I was surprisingly calm in the moment, perhaps because the water was washing away the blood, and I limped the 50 yards back up to the house, where my aunt was sitting on the deck, drinking her morning coffee. Auntie Bonnie, I said, I think I cut my foot. By then, my Aunt Bonnie was well used to my injuries. Virtually every time I was left in her charge, I'd come limping back to her with some broken bone, sprain, burn, or open wound. It became a running joke in the family that she should refuse to look after me because I posed too much of an insurance risk. My injuries were so routine that she barely blinked when I told her I'd cut my foot. I'll go get a Band-Aid, she sighed without looking up at me. I don't know why I didn't stop her and say, listen, lady, there's no time for Band-Aids. We need super glue and maybe also a miracle. But she was a pharmacist, which is basically a doctor, so I trusted her. Either way, she was gone before I could say anything. A few minutes later, she returned with a bandage. By then, there was a small pool of blood forming beneath me, and her eyes widened ever so slightly as she got closer, in that way that adults' eyes tend to widen when they realize things are more fucked than they originally realized, but don't want to admit it out loud. Oh, she said with a kind of forced composure. You really cut it, huh? She tried to say it calmly, but I have a knack for picking up on the panic in people's voices, especially when they're staring at an open wound in my body, and I could tell what she really meant to say was, we'll be lucky if we can save the leg. She used a water bottle to clear the blood away and tried to see how deep the cut was, but when she peeled back the skin for just a moment, she let out the faintest of gasps. I could see what she saw, too. A dark spot, maybe a piece of dirt. That lake was filthy, after all, hence the broken beer bottle, but it looked more like part of a vein, maybe even an artery, and even though I don't entirely know the difference between a vein and an artery, or whether there are even arteries in your feet, who knows, it looked bad, like what you'd imagine cutting an artery would look like. I went pale. The blood kept coming. Let's just call your mom, Aunt Bonnie said, but I knew what she really meant. Think about what you'd like to say to your mother before you die. I could hear her dialing the phone. By now, my parents would be on their way to the cottage, the car bounding down the highway with bottles of beer rattling in the seat where I would have been uncomfortably squished otherwise. Hey, Deb, she said almost calmly when my mother answered. Are you guys close? Almost, my mother said. Why? Is everything okay? Debbie, always assuming the worst has happened. Yep, everything's good, Aunt Bonnie said, even though she really meant, you left your dainty, fragile piece of shit son with me, and now he's going to die. I could tell she didn't want to get my mother worried, especially not when there was nothing she could do, not from the highway at least. And to be perfectly honest, I was fine with her not knowing. My mother is a notoriously worried woman, and I knew the second she learned I nearly cut off my foot, she'd go on and on about how we never should have been allowed near the water without military-grade protective bodysuits, at least 3 adult supervisors, and a written permission slip from a medical professional. My mother absolutely insisted that we all wear water shoes, those disgustingly ugly mesh clogs that meld to your feet the second they get wet. I hated water shoes. I hated that they filled with dirt and sand and gave my feet a rash. I hated that they made my feet feel heavy and dull. I hated the hideous colors they were designed in, and I hated knowing that I would now almost certainly never hear the end of it. Aunt Bonnie looked at me the way you look at a bird that's flown into a window and broken its wing, the look that says, "You'll be dead within the hour, you poor idiot. Let's go to the bathroom and see if we can clean it out," she said. And so I hobbled to the bathroom, my cousins now crowded around me, and placed my bloody stump under the bathtub faucet. Aunt Bonnie bent down and tried spreading the wound so the water could clean inside of it. I could tell she was trying to see if the dark spot was going away, if it was only a piece of dirt and not an open artery spilling out the last of my life force. The spot wouldn't go away. The bleeding had somewhat abated, but it hadn't stopped entirely. We wrapped it in paper towels. Aunt Bonnie picked up the phone again. I could tell her concern was growing. She'd had a perfect record so far in terms of making sure I hadn't died, but this time was shaping up differently. I mean, all told, even if I had died, spoiler alert, I didn't die. Her record still would have been pretty good. One death out of mostly not dying is not too bad. She dialed my mother again, and I could hear her answer. "Hey, Deb," Aunt Bonnie said, less convincingly calm this time. "Almost here?" "We're 5 minutes away," my mother said. "Something's wrong. I can tell." "Well," Aunt Bonnie said, "there's been an incident." A moment passed while my mother waited for news that I'd been decapitated, castrated, or worse. "Well, Matthew stepped on a piece of glass and, he might have cut an artery." "An artery?" I could hear my mother scream through the phone. "Yeah, maybe just a little bit," Aunt Bonnie said. But my mother was already crying. My father, you could hear, was yelling from the driver's seat. "God damn it, it's always fucking something." "Oh God, why are you crying?" my brother was asking from the back seat. "Auntie Bonnie said he cut an artery," my mother was sobbing. "Do you want me to scream like he's doing?" The dog, I'm sure, vomited one last time. This is how my family reacts to news. A few minutes later, the car came shrieking down the gravel road. My mother leapt from the passenger seat, and before I had a chance to say hello, I'd been swept into the back seat, boxes of groceries tossed onto the pavement to make room for my failing body, and we were speeding back down the gravel road to the emergency room. "You just need a few stitches," is what the doctor said when he'd finally had a chance to look me over. "Are you sure, doctor?" my mother was asking. "Are you sure he hasn't cut an artery?" I would make fun of her for questioning the doctor on something that would be obvious to a doctor, but then again, this was small-town Michigan. The hospital was in between a Dairy Queen and a Blockbuster Video. "Yes," he said. "He'd be dead if he cut an artery." A tetanus shot, a handful of stitches, and a bag full of prescription painkillers later, we were driving back to the cottage, the open green fields of Michigan passing by the window. I'd like to say I looked out that window and said something profound, something that someone who's really gone through stuff says, like, "You never know how much you've been missing until you almost lose it all." But I couldn't say that. All I could muster before the pain drugs took over was one simple sentence. This never would have happened if we just went to fucking Disneyland. On the Terrors of Nature. I've never understood people who actually enjoy being outdoors. I understand you can't exactly avoid going outside. I admit I leave my apartment for 10 minutes every day, to retrieve sandwiches and cookies to drag back to my lair, but I certainly don't have fun doing it. Outside is where the sun's piercing rays sear my skin. Outside is where spiders breed and plot ways to penetrate my kitchen. Outside is where bears live, like actual bears that roam around waiting to rip your arms and legs off and eat them like stale chicken wings. If I didn't need nutrition or occasional sunlight to survive, rest assured, my apartment door would stay permanently bolted. My distaste of nature began as early as I can remember, during one disastrous weekend my family spent RVing in Wisconsin. In their youthful naivete, my parents not only enjoyed being outdoors, but actively sought time to be outside exclusively, like some kind of forest animals, content with only the trees and a bonfire and a fully equipped RV. I was never on board with the concept of the RV, even as an infant, when I still regularly shit my pants. If you're putting an entire house on wheels just to drive it into the woods, why don't you just stay in the fucking house? You can call it a recreational vehicle all you want, but an RV will always be the vehicle you don't want to drive behind on the highway because there's a 100% chance that an infant child is giving you the middle finger from the rear window. I was that infant child, and that middle finger was my cry for help. I like to point out this fact to clarify that I myself was never an RVer. Simply the child of RVers and an unwitting participant in the culture of RVing. And yes, RVing is not just an activity, but an entire culture with a rich history of camping in Walmart parking lots and dumping buckets of piss and shit on the side of the American interstate highway system. It's a beautiful culture, respected by many and disrespected by many more. My parents never owned an RV, but our family friend Sue owned one, and that was good enough for us. Sue was an old, sprightly woman who worked with my parents years earlier at the department store where they met. Yes, my parents met working at a department store. I am a child of coupons and cheap garments. By the time I was born, Sue was already widowed and retired and spent her free time driving out into the wilderness to enjoy nature. I loved Sue. She had a nasty sense of humor. Most of the time I didn't know what she was laughing about, but I laughed along with her anyway. She had a bunch of cactuses in her house that were taller than I was, and a full basement with a pool table and a bunch of paintings of clowns that, when the lights were turned off, I'm pretty sure sprang to life to feast on cubes of beef and carrion that Sue flung to them from upstairs. She was a quirky old broad who would do stuff like that. The camper, as it was affectionately called, was always parked in Sue's driveway. We were never allowed inside of it when we were at Sue's house, just like we only got to go to the basement while the clown paintings were sleeping, but I'd always wondered what happened inside of it. I was probably only 4 or 5 at the time, but I remember being fascinated by the idea that someone would actually want to fit an entire house onto a big old bus and take it into the wilderness for fun. But of course, we soon got invited to go with Sue on a camping trip, and I would discover exactly why fitting your entire house onto a bus is perhaps not the most ideal arrangement. This was before that fucking Tiny House Hunter show on HGTV fetishized the idea of living in a cardboard box. No offense to people who live in cardboard boxes, but I prefer to sleep in a bed that's more than 12 inches away from the toilet, and I resent the entire Home and Gardens television network for suggesting I should want otherwise. So one weekend, my mom, dad, brother, and I drove for what felt like an entire day to get to Sue's camper in Wisconsin. I'm sure it was only 4 hours, possibly less, and parked in a campground near a lake. I remember the excitement I felt when I got out of the car and the immediate disappointment I felt when I saw where we had parked. The campground was nothing more than a patch of dirt no larger than a strip mall parking lot next to a lake so overrun with tree roots and algae you could barely tell where the shore ended and the water began. Even if you wanted to jump in, there'd be no way to return without climbing through bushes and muck. You'd think, as an infant, I wouldn't have had the worldly experience to distinguish a bad outdoors experience from a good one, but I knew this was shit. At least there's a swimming pool on the campground, my mother tried to assure us. But when we walked by the pool to investigate, we discovered a hole full of green, cloudy water and a single used diaper floating listlessly in the center, crushing all of my hopes and dreams. When we got inside the camper to clean up after our day-long journey to Wisconsin, we discovered that the water supply along this particular lake was apparently high in hydrogen sulfide gas, causing what is otherwise known as sulfur water, or water that smells like someone shit out a dozen deviled eggs and then sprayed it with the blood of a dozen other deviled eggs that had been freshly killed earlier that morning. They say smell can be the strongest trigger for memory, which is perhaps why I remember this weekend so vividly over two decades later, because it smelled like death the entire time. Honestly, I don't remember why we didn't turn right around and drive back that minute. I'm sure I used my limited vocabulary to advocate for that very action. But being an RVer means never saying no to a challenge, so apparently we spent an entire weekend bathing in boiled egg water and just dealing with it. I asked my mother years later why the hell we didn't turn around and go straight back home when we turned on the faucet and the cursed souls of egg demons poured from the tap, and she said we stayed to, quote, enjoy each other's company. Because apparently some people are satisfied by nothing more than conversation with other humans and are willing to overlook the minor inconveniences of tainted water and diaper pools. And yet the sulfur water was hardly the only terrible thing about that weekend. It was all terrible. There were bugs. It was itchy. We spent the whole weekend sitting by a campfire where I learned that my body is extremely allergic to mosquitoes, which is a thing you can actually be allergic to because every one of their tiny clawing bites turned into a giant welt. My only toy that weekend was a fly swatter, which I used to great effect, but still. I was being literally eaten alive in a tiny house car with nothing but egg water to soothe my wounds. On top of all of that, I had the distinct privilege, as the youngest camper that weekend, of sleeping on the breakfast table. In true RV fashion, the surface of the kitchen table was detachable and, with a few maneuvers, turned into a bed. Imagine a restaurant booth, but take away the supporting leg and put the tabletop flush between the seats, and voila, you got yourself an RV bed. At least that's how they sold it to me when they told me I was sleeping on a breakfast table. Once you get over the initial excitement of getting to sleep or you eat your Fruit Loops, you realize you're sleeping on a literal table, which is perhaps the least appealing of sleeping surfaces. I was a kid, dehydrated from a scarcity of egg-free drinking water and sapped of all my blood from thirsty mosquitoes, so I'm sure I passed out. When we finally escaped on Sunday evening, the rest of my family apparently content enough with a weekend of one another's company, I spent the entire car ride home scratching my mosquito bites into bloody gashes and cursing the outdoors forever. Nature, I knew then more than ever, was nothing more than an itchy, putrid adventure into hell itself. The older I got and the more time I spent ignoring the outdoors, the more my distaste for nature evolved into genuine fear. Do I wish I could have grown into one of those burly men from the Discovery Channel who can make his own venison jerky and chase hurricanes and put out forest fires? Sure, but only because they get to spend a lot of very intimate time with other burly men in scant clothing, and I'm about that life. But alas, I grew into a true nature sissy, terrified not only by being outside, but by what nature could do to me while I was indoors. The very earliest dream I can remember was a nightmare I had when I couldn't have been more than a few years old. I was playing outside when, in seconds, the sky turned violently gray and then pitch black, and I woke up in a pile of snot and tears and probably urine, if we're being honest, and it took a few packages of frozen waffles to console me. There were no tall buildings in the suburbs where I grew up, so anytime there was bad weather, you could see the angry, dark sky for miles and miles, and it always made me feel so small and defenseless. We lived on the periphery of the tornado belt, after all. Every year at school, we'd have tornado drills, where we'd crawl into the hallways and roll into balls against the wall, and sometimes, if you didn't get into the hallway quick enough, you'd have to start forming a row behind the kids who were already against the wall, so your tiny face was up in some other kid's butt. But that was the price we paid for staying safe. I'd seen The Wizard of Oz enough times to know that tornadoes weren't fucking around. I mean, sure, A tornado flung Dorothy to a land of tiny dancing homosexuals, which I wouldn't have been opposed to, but also her house literally killed someone. I wasn't about to be the next person with fabulous shoes to get killed in a tornado. And yes, that's an entirely normal fear to have. Long before I was born, my mother's cousin was killed in a tornado in the next town over, and perhaps it was my mother's constant repetition of that story, or perhaps it was something deeper, but every summer, my fear of storms got worse and worse. One summer, my mother was mowing the lawn with an electric mower that was plugged into an outlet with a long, winding extension cord. It started pouring rain and she didn't stop mowing, and I went outside and stood next to her, literally screaming my eyes out over the claps of thunder because I was sure she was about to be electrocuted to death. Which is a concern I would maintain today, not the brightest idea on her part. I was sobbing convulsively, convinced that if she weren't electrocuted, she'd definitely be struck by lightning or swept up by a tornado that was obviously headed directly to our house. She finished the job, which I'm sure I made 10 times more difficult by standing in her path, and somehow she was never electrocuted to death, but it remains possibly the most scared I've ever been. There was one storm in particular, probably around 1998, that struck while we were at a public pool. And yes, before you judge us, we went to public pools. We didn't get a fancy above-ground pool in our backyard until the 2000s, so we were forced to go swimming in public like animals. It was a balmy, cloudy day, but otherwise stormless, and the entire family went. About halfway through the day, a lifeguard spotted lightning and made everybody get out of the water until the storm clouds passed over, which was perfectly fine because it was lunchtime and I was hungry. While we sat unpeeling our peanut butter sandwiches from their damp plastic wraps, I looked up and saw a sinister cloud billowing toward us, a plume of green-gray smoke. I'd seen plenty of storm clouds before, but no cloud moved as menacingly as this one, like a thick snake uncoiling rapidly above us. Suddenly, the winds whipped violently around us, the rain came down like bullets, and everybody was running in a different direction. "This is the big one!" my mother screamed. A sign from the hot dog stand came loose and flew down and hit the person next to me in the head. I stood up, threw away my entire sandwich, and ran for the closest structure, the women's bathroom. We all darted inside and clung to the concrete walls, which shook against the wind. I turned to find my older cousin sobbing uncontrollably with a hot dog in his hand. His body was convulsing, but he kept eating. It remains the most hilarious yet terrifying moment of my childhood. Eventually, the storm passed and we all survived, but a giant tree was literally ripped from its roots and thrown into the shallow end of the pool where we'd been swimming a half hour earlier. So to anyone who says that my fear of nature is unfounded, that I'm a grown-ass man who lives in a city where the most dangerous wildlife are dog-sized cockroaches and rat kings, that your chances of getting bit by a radioactive spider or swept away in a tornado, especially in New York City, are far less than the chances of slipping in the shower as a result of dancing too hard to a Spice Girls song and trying to finish my sub sandwich, know that my terror is well-rooted in a history of what I consider dramatic near deaths, and I'm lucky to be alive. You can take your outdoors propaganda to the next fool, unfazed by the presence of vicious cyclones and bloodthirsty bears. And when he gets ripped apart and thrown to another state, I'll be inside, under 3 layers of sheets and blankets, whispering over and over, "I told you so." On teenagers, and why they're the worst. There is no species on Earth that strikes as much fear in my heart as the American teenager. And yes, I'm singling out Americans because I'm pretty sure teenagers don't even exist in other countries. In France, they go right from being babies to being cigarette-smoking, coffee-swilling adult men with lush chest hair, and that's not even an offensive description because everybody in France would agree with me. I have a friend who's French, and she says so. But we're talking about America here, where babies grow up to be even bigger babies, and all we really get along the way is incurable anxiety and crippling student loan debt. We're the only country in the world where children are coddled for a full 25 to 40 years, and teenagers, falling right in the middle of that incubation period, are given free rein to wreak terror on society. I, for one, am not a fan of teenagers, if you couldn't tell, and not just because they know more about sex than I do. Teenagers are objectively terrifying. They gather in parking lots and behind gas stations and under bridges, plotting ways to destroy the world, and I don't trust them even a little bit. You would think that their lanky, underdeveloped bodies would be vulnerable, like a snake after it molts its skin, but somehow the mixture of teenage angst and hormones festers to create an unpredictable beast unseen anywhere else in nature. It astounds me that we actively encourage teenagers to become babysitters. Babysitters, as in the people we trust to sit on our nation's babies. Oh, sure, you can barely control your own disgusting body, but go ahead and take care of my completely defenseless infant. Also, here's some car keys, because you may only be 16 and your brain isn't fully developed yet, but I trust you implicitly to operate my 4,000-pound vehicle. Honestly, I miss the old days, when everybody died peacefully of cholera at the ripe old age of 13, surrounded by their grandchildren. But let's focus. Teenagers are disgusting. Their bodies produce fragrances and flavors that could unclog even the most congested of sinuses. Their skin is sticky, they smell, and they have absolutely no regard for basic garbage disposal. I'll be honest, I don't know how my mother managed to live with my father and two teenage boys for a full decade without burning down the house the second she found a questionable tissue stuck to the carpet. Ecologists could write volumes about the communities of organisms that lived in my teenage bedsheets alone. I went into my brother's bedroom once and saw a pillowcase physically carry itself across the room to feed on the bottom of a nearly empty bowl of cereal. That's real. That really happened. Some say he still sleeps on the same unwashed sheets today. Me, I say that. Worst of all, the modern American teenager is merciless in attitude. Perhaps it's because they don't yet realize life will one day utterly destroy them, or perhaps it's because they do, but teenagers have the unique ability to emotionally ravage you without lifting a single finger. And I'm not talking about the gangs of them that wait outside Dunkin' Donuts every morning to taunt me for buying 3 boxes of assorted munchkins and sweatpants. I'm talking about teenagers on the internet. I happen to make my living writing on the internet. It's a meager profession, and I have to sell my body on the side to make ends meet, but generally speaking, it comes with very little risk. The only workplace hazards I face regularly are masturbating too many times in a row until it starts to kind of hurt, taking too long of a shower and turning into a lifeless prune, and choking to death on an egg roll because I don't have a strapping, muscled boyfriend to perform the Heimlich on me. But I would take any of those things over the real danger I face every day, the cutting insult from a mean-as-hell teenage girl. Because I've chosen to write about my interests, which happen to include attractive young men, pop music, boy band stars, and television programs featuring all of the above, I've somehow attracted a regular audience of intensely feral teenage girls who collectively make up a stronger offensive force than all of the world's militaries combined. Seriously, if teenage girls decide to organize one day, there's literally nothing we can do to stop them. Just go on the internet and look up pictures from any Justin Bieber concert. There are girls bursting through steel barricades, dismembering security guards, and feasting on one another's flesh. And this is all before we've even allowed them to vote. When they like you, of course, there's no problem. In fact, I've had plenty of perfectly rewarding interactions with teenage girls on the internet, which is a sentence that would normally land a grown man like myself on Dateline, but it's okay because we're preying on Zac Efron and not one another. But say one wrong thing, however innocuous yet hilarious you think it may be, and you become teenage girl enemy number one. And let me tell you, teenage angst knows no borders. I've been yelled at in more languages and from more countries than I knew existed. All for daring to say that a boy band member, who shall remain nameless because I value my life, should perhaps cut his hair an inch shorter and possibly consider using shampoo. And teenage girls don't hold back. I'm chubby, gay, pale, and a whole decade older than most of them, which means I might as well wear a sign that says, "Hello, fellow internet users. Please destroy my entire life." I've been called an untoasted marshmallow, an old loaf of Wonder Bread, a slice of unbuttered toast. A lot of their insults are carb-based. A balding, middle-aged menace, someone who should go ahead and kill himself already, and my personal favorite, Casper the Faggot Ghost, which would be offensive if it weren't so clever and nostalgic. Kudos to today's youth for honoring a classic 90s movie. Also, human Casper was adorable, so fuck you, teens. Of course, I've angered a great many people on the internet for a number of reasons. It's kind of impossible to exist on the internet without angering at least 10% of the people who interact with you. But insults from teenage girls always seem to cut deepest. I have a number of theories as to why this is true. Some would say society pressures girls into living up to impossible standards and turns them against one another at the earliest possible age, meaning they're literally prepared for war at all times and are likely to lash out at whatever target happens to provoke them at any given moment, which is usually me, a pasty gay who's writing about their favorite Jonas Brother. It also doesn't help that I show up to their concerts and stand in front of them and scream louder than they do, but I can't help that my hormones are just as aggressive as theirs. But the theory that seems most true is the simplest. Teenagers are assholes. So let's talk about teenage assholes. Not like literal teenage assholes. If the FBI is listening to this, please don't arrest me for saying teenage assholes. It's not what you think. I'm talking about teenage assholes like teenagers who are assholes, not teenagers who have assholes. Although probably every teenager has an asshole, so I guess we're talking about teenagers who do technically have assholes, but we're not talking about their literal assholes, we're talking about how they are assholes. I'm glad we cleared that up. Anyway, let's talk about teenage assholes. I was a teenage asshole. And not just any teenage asshole, but the worst kind of teenage asshole, the self-righteous, nerdy teenage asshole. Yes, nerds can be assholes too, and sometimes they're even worse assholes than the other types of assholes because they grow up thinking that the world owes them something for making them a nerd. I would have saved myself a lot of trouble if I could have gone back and told this to my child self. I would have taken that scruffy ginger nerd by the collar and shook him till his glasses fell off. It's what he deserved. But alas, I became the asshole I would so despise. In third grade, I fashioned myself a budding sociologist and laid out what I believed to be an irrefutable system by which I could categorize the entire third grade class. There were, according to my scientific observations, three distinct social echelons into which every one of my classmates could be placed. There were the popular kids, of course, the girls with pretty hair and the boys who could run faster than 100 feet without bending over in agonizing pain. There were the obviously unpopular kids, the girl who sat inside during recess to read books, and the boy who brought his pet mouse to the playground in his jacket pocket. Listen, I know these are cruel and arbitrary factors, but really, what the fuck kind of child brings a mouse to school? And then there was the third in-between group of kids who clearly weren't popular, but weren't exactly unpopular, who simply existed beneath the radar, somewhere in the middle of it all. I'll let you guess which group I placed myself in. This is, of course, a complete asshole's way of thinking, and a cheap way for an insecure little shit to convince himself he's not at the bottom of the totem pole. And sure, I was like the class clown or whatever, and that counted for something, but still, dick move. I guess it was important for my nerdy, chubby, insecure self to have a place, even if that place was a fantasy land I created in the middle of the social order. I could never be one of the quirky, carefree kids who didn't give a flying fuck about what other people thought of him. I cared deeply about what everybody else thought, and even if I wasn't the most popular, it mattered that there was an identity that I fit into. And this way of thinking stayed with me well into high school, where my nerdy assholeness could reach its fullest form. I needed an identity to cling to, after all, even if that identity was to be an asshole nerd. So that's what I became. There are all types of nerds in the world. There are nerds who play wizard card games, and nerds who play chess, and nerds who read comic books, and nerds who know way too much about Star Wars. I was a math and science nerd. When I started high school in 2004, I tested high enough on my entrance exams to skip freshman-level honors algebra and jump right into sophomore-level honors geometry, which would be impressive if this wasn't the public school system in suburban Chicago, where a literal monkey could have broken the curve. I don't know if you've ever been to a public school, especially one in Chicago, but it's basically prison, but with paler food and more bathroom sex. Seriously. One day, we found a loose DVD of heterosexual pornography on the cafeteria floor. Straight porn, where we ate. Disgusting. Anyway, I happened to be one of two 13-year-olds who outsmarted the system, and I started my first day of high school a virtual prodigy. Now, it's not easy being a boy genius. Everybody assumes it's all fun and games and strippers and cocaine. You'll be so popular, they say. All the ladies will love you. You'll grow up and Russell Crowe will play you in the movies. But let's be real. Being a boy genius is hard work. You have to get new glasses every 2 months because your eyes are so terrible. You have to bring candies to the teachers so they know you're a suck-up. And legally, you're required to fail gym class. But something in my brain responded to being called smart. It made me feel good that I was the smart kid. It had its negative connotations, but at least I knew who I was, so I leaned into it. I carried around heavy books because it made me feel smarter. My backpack weighed over 100 pounds and stuck out at least 10 inches from my back, and I'm sure it led to long-term spinal degeneration, but it was worth it for the extra time I got to spend studying. I studied aggressively for tests because I needed to get not just an A, but the highest score in class. There weren't enough periods in the day for the number of AP and honors classes I wanted to fit into my schedule. Literally. I had to petition the administration to let me skip my lunch period to add on AP biology. I was literally begging the school to let me sacrifice the one good thing in this world. And here's where I became an asshole, or at least started my journey toward assholedom. I prized good grades over any meaningful relationships. I wanted to be the smartest. I didn't like sharing my notes or even studying with other people. Group projects were my personal hell. Seriously, fuck you if you ever ask me to cheat. Some girl tricked me into sharing my binder of meticulous notes, which I know for a fact she straight up photocopied before giving back to me. Every time we took a test, I'd create an impenetrable tent out of my shoulders and arms so nobody could catch even a glance at my answers and steal my precious knowledge. By the way, children, if you're reading this, cheating is totally fine. Nobody cares, as long as you cheat together. Don't give anybody your answers unless there's something in it for you. The bargaining and socializing skills you'll learn in these transactions will be far more useful to you in the future than any actual knowledge you're losing by cheating. So go ahead. Eventually, the grind broke me. I was constantly sarcastic, bitter, snappy, and worse, perpetually exhausted, which made me even more insufferable to be around. I went to the doctor for fatigue, and that's when he first suggested that maybe I wasn't just overworked, but depressed, which not only makes your brain feel like it would constantly be better off with a nap, but also that you're somehow not good enough. Regardless of the source of my insufferableness, there's nothing worse than a teenager who thinks he knows more than everybody else. My mother would ask me to clean up a pile of junk I'd left on the stairs, and I'd dramatically shout back something like, "You know I could be a drug dealer, right? I could be out on the streets doing all kinds of marijuana right now, but no, I'm wasting my time being an honors child." It's like she didn't even appreciate the bumper sticker I got for her every semester. Applying to college only made things worse. There's nothing like cornering a child who's already racked with hormones, acne, and itchy pubic hair and pressuring them into sacrificing their sanity for higher education. I mean, I was a teenager. I could barely be trusted to stay at home by myself without accidentally setting fire to a frozen pizza. And now colleges were like, "It's no big deal. We just need you to figure out what you want to do with the next 65 years of your life." There's a thing that happens when you're kind of smart in public school, and that is you get fed into a machine. that demands that you try your very hardest to make it to college. You have to get the best grades and join 11 clubs and be good at sports and speak 5 languages and nurse wounded animals back to health. And I fell into it hard. The whole process of going to college is fucked. First, you have to pass a bunch of tests to prove that you know enough to even be able to go to college. Then you have to know where the fuck you want to go. Then you have to write approximately 17 personal essays, and all the example essays they give you are by people who almost died of cancer or cured AIDS in their hometown. Neither of my parents went to college, and as much as they wanted to help me through the process, they didn't know how, and it only made my teenage asshole self more resentful and self-entitled. Fine, I thought, I'll figure this shit out myself. Just get ready to write a very large student loan check every month for the next 20 to 50 years, and we'll totally be okay. Making it even worse, my arch-rival, Alonzo Garcia. That's not his real name, but I want you to know it's close to his real name, so don't go thinking I made up some fake-sounding Mexican name just because he was Mexican. Anyway, Alonzo was the cooler, multicultural version of me. Besides being a fellow boy genius, he was a college admissions counselor's wet dream. He was a soccer and volleyball star. He emigrated from Guadalajara when he was 6 years old and can read and write fluently in both English and Spanish. And he was socially adept enough to be charming with absolutely everybody. I'm sure he cured babies with cancer in his spare time. Alonzo and I were friends, but our friendship was infused with a potent rivalry. Who would get a better score on the ACT? Who would get into the better college, and who would be valedictorian? There could only be one, and we were both after it. And by both of us, I mean me, and Alonzo just happened to be there too. I think in retrospect, he got more fulfillment out of watching me try to best him than from actually winning. But I cared. Oh, did I care. Of course, Alonzo was always ahead. He scored higher on the ACT, got into all the best schools, and was our valedictorian. He gave some beautiful bilingual valedictory speech that I probably would have remembered if I hadn't been so busy seething in anger at the time. He's married now with kids and a job and everything, and I'm just here writing about how I hate children. But at the time, Alonzo kept me on my toes, and I was determined to nerd out as hard as I could. So, in addition to taking every class I could, I insisted on joining every club there was, which, according to most kids and also movies about high school, is only a thing that high schoolers do when they want to take long trips to state tournaments so they can stay overnight in hotel rooms with other high schoolers and also do dirty stuff on the bus ride there. I, not surprisingly, was in it for the game. Yes. I was a mathlete, and yes, before you ask, I was indeed our team's MVP. I was also editor of the school paper, and for good measure, treasurer of the art club, which was actually just a bunch of closeted gay children who spent their afternoons pretending they were simply eccentric and not also homosexual. Perhaps most illustratively, though, I was president of the science club, a group whose primary purpose was to give nerds like me a place to escape getting beat up after school. We spent half of the year building what's called a Rube Goldberg machine, which is basically the game Mousetrap, a ridiculous contraption that takes 1,000 ridiculous steps involving marbles and slides and falling shoes and buckets that all happen one after the other like falling dominoes. Each year there's a national Rube Goldberg competition, and nerdy engineerlings and science clubs across the country gather their pimply faces together to build a dumb machine that does a dumb thing. And you better believe our nerdy asses were in the game. The task this particular year was to build a machine that could assemble a simple hamburger, a pre-cooked patty, lettuce, tomato, ketchup, mustard, and pickles with a bottom and top bun. Now, to remind you again, we were a science club in a public school in Chicago. Well, technically the suburbs, but still. We weren't working with titanium steel or precious oaks and marbles. We could afford a box of rubber bands, a pile of toothpicks, and a heap of rotted wood someone's dad left at the side of the garage. Somehow, we had to turn this into a working structure that could assemble an edible hamburger. We spent months working on this thing, sketching diagrams and building prototypes and causing a not insignificant number of small but terrifying table fires. And finally, under what I can only imagine was my stellar leadership, we built ourselves a clunky monstrosity that put together a goddamn burger. I mean, barely, and only about 10% of the time, but we were proud of it nonetheless. Here's how it worked. Our creation was carnival-themed, with the bottom bun sitting on a carousel in the center of the structure. When the machine launched, the carousel would start to spin, and each of the ingredients would fall neatly into place on top of the bun. The patty fell through a Plinko-style tower that triggered a hammer, that smashed a bottle of ketchup, that set off a bell, that triggered a butcher knife, that swung into a head of lettuce, and so on and so forth until we had a fully constructed burger glistening in the center. At least that was the idea. We were 10 16-year-olds with nothing but hot glue guns, moldy sesame seed buns, and feral hormones. Our machine worked in theory, but more often than not, a string snapped here, a knife flung there. Our machine would start smoking under duress, and we'd devolve into a battle over who fucked it up this time. There were days when we thought bringing this mess to a competition would surely bring more embarrassment than glory, and we considered letting it burn itself to the ground. But by sheer force of will, we got our beautiful burger baby to cooperate just long enough to do what it had to do. And so, on the morning of the state championship in downtown Chicago, we lugged it onto a bus and brought her in. And by the way, I don't know if you've ever been on a bus with a bunch of teenage nerds and a pile of cheap wood that's been covered in raw beef and cheese for 5 months, but it's not pretty. The fact that we survived that bus ride was a miracle unto itself. But the biggest miracle of all was what happened when we got there. Because guess what? We won that shit. We won it all. Good old Burger Machine did her very best, and we clobbered the other nerds and their measly attempts at engineering perfection. In retrospect, we more than likely won because the other Chicago schools were even more ridiculously underfunded than us. But still, we fucking did it. A week later, we went to Nationals, a contest so highly prestigious and respected that they held it in none other than an empty warehouse in West Lafayette, Indiana. We went in with as much confidence as 10 virgins hot off a stunning upset victory can muster in a situation like this, and, as you would probably suspect, got utterly and horrendously destroyed. Good old Burger Machine just couldn't survive the bumpy 2-hour bus ride from Chicago to West Lafayette and lost her magic. Besides, it was bound to happen when you pit a Chicago public school from the suburbs, but still, against a bunch of high schools with words like institute in their names. We didn't have a chance. But the week in between our victory and loss was a fantastic one. Yes, it was the nerdiest accomplishment possible, and no, we didn't get a pep rally or anything, but still, victory validated our dweeby existences and gave me even more fuel to continue my nerdy conquests. Later that same year, still fueled by Rube Goldberg glory, the Science Club entered the Chicago South Suburban Science Invitational, a regional competition of veritable geeks in all areas of science from all over Chicagoland. It was generally less nerdy than it sounds. There were contests for the strongest popsicle stick bridge, the lightest paper airplane, and the farthest traveling mousetrap-powered vehicle. Our school entered students in every category for the broadest possible chance at victory. My category? Insect identification. Now, I know what you're thinking. Matt, you hate bugs. And even though I never said that and you just assumed it because I'm a giant gay pansy with absolutely no backbone, you are absolutely right. I hate bugs. I think they're gross and ungodly and responsible for billions of dollars in crop damage annually. And I refuse to support any broad group of the animal kingdom that plays even the smallest part in limiting my access to potatoes. But listen, duty calls. And when duty requires that you spend an entire night of your precious teenage years making and studying flashcards to identify which of the 29 taxonomic orders of insects a butterfly belongs to, you fucking do it. It's Lepidoptera, by the way, you moron. I stayed up all night studying those flashcards until I could classify a bumblebee with my eyes closed and my hands tied behind my back. and I walked into the Chicago South Suburban Science Invitational Insect Identification Contest like a mounted knight enters his field of battle. 20 minutes later, I walked out a christened insect king. First place! In fact, I would have gotten a perfect score if the exam proctor had conceded that what he believed was a true bug, order Hemiptera, was obviously just an unconvincing beetle, order Coleoptera. But that man was an idiot and a coward. And guess who walked out of there with a first-place blue ribbon and $25 Applebee's gift card? Not him. By now, you understand quite well that my nerdiness had gotten out of control. I'd become merciless. I was an almighty nerd, my identity unquestioned. Anybody who stood in my way was subject to my wrath. Alonzo, the preppy West Lafayette Institute kids, the insect man, they were all just people in my way. So I understand now why teenagers are assholes. They know who they are, and we're just in their way. But that doesn't mean I have to like them. On my first 100 days as President of the United States. Nobody likes a complainer who doesn't put forth solutions. Or at least that's what people like to say when they get tired of listening to someone complain. The reality is, some things don't have solutions. That's why we're complaining about them. If I could fix half the shit I rant about, maybe I'd be a happier person and the world would be a better place. But like those old English guys said in that song that one time, you don't always get what you want. So shut the fuck up and stop complaining about people complaining. Or something like that, I don't really remember. Nonetheless, I thought it wise to put forth an agenda, a working plan, if you will, of priorities that I might enact were I elected to a position to make them possible. I'm not saying that this is the official declaration of my campaign for president, but if I were saying that, you might consider the following as the top of my to-do list. Decrees I would make immediately as president. 1. Vice President Oprah Winfrey is to be appointed chief ego booster to the president, and each day, she is to recite positive affirmations at me until I cry. 2. Any vegetable claiming to be a noodle, however thinly it may be sliced, is to be immediately exterminated. And any person who dare claims their vegetable is a noodle shall be sentenced to a life of hard labor in a pasta factory so they may understand that the true art of noodle making will never include zucchini. 3. It shall be legal to violently murder any person who steps off of an airplane, walks down the little hallway, and then stands right in front of the exit while they figure out where to go when there's a whole line of people waiting behind them. 4. All starbursts will be pink starbursts, and all who protest in favor of yellow, orange, or red will be executed on the spot in the name of our Lord and Savior, the almighty and powerful pink starburst. 5. All public restroom stalls shall be fitted with doors that span the entire stall, leaving no gap for creepy coworkers to leer at you mid-bowel movement, even though sometimes you understand the urge to see yourself pooping through the gap in the stall door. 6. All hot guys with cute dogs shall be enlisted in the president's secret reserves and called to serve at the pleasure of the president. 7. No reclining on airplanes because it's a dick move and it should never have been allowed in the first place. Honestly, the person behind you has like 6 inches of freedom in front of their face and you're just gonna jerk back your cowardly spine and deprive them of air to breathe all for an extra 10 degrees of comfort? You're an asshole and so is everybody you love. 8. Babies are to be kept on silent at all times. And if one goes off in public, it shall be discarded. 9. Honking a car horn for longer than 1 second shall be considered a crime punishable by an unrelenting air horn directly to the eardrum until explosion. 10. All microwaves shall heat Hot Pockets to the perfect temperature, whereby the saucy center is heated evenly with the crusty surface. 11. anybody who complains about not liking the Kardashians shall be banned from enjoying anything ever again. Sorry you didn't get famous for no reason. Let people enjoy their fucking reality TV show. 12. All squirrels are to be humanely euthanized, and their meat is to be baked into pies given to disobedient children at Christmas time. 13. Any man who wishes to wear a V-neck in public